Support for WMNF comes from our members and Frog Song Organics. Each week, Frog Song Organics delivers healthy produce and pasture-raised meats directly to homes and businesses in the Tampa Bay area. More at frogsongorganics.com, featuring seasonal crops, online shopping, and CSA.
Hello, and welcome to the Sustainable Living Show here on WMNF Tampa. Today's show, we are talking about a very important topic today, the health of our waterways. Your hosts today are myself, Tanya Vidovic, Frank Knox, and Grace Benke. Grace, are you there?
I'm here. You can't hear me.
Okay, we can hear you now, Grace.
Hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you now.
Well, let's get back to it then. Today we're speaking with Justin Bloom of the Tampa Bay Waterkeepers Alliance. Justin is an environmental lawyer with significant experience developing and directing programs and projects for environmental groups, in addition to decades of legal practice focusing on environmental issues. He is also the founder and a board member of the neighboring Suncoast Waterkeeper. Welcome, Justin.
Hi, thanks. Glad to be joining you guys.
Great. Can you start by telling our listeners a little bit about the Tampa Bay Waterkeepers Alliance and their mission?
Sure. I'm going to wear a couple hats this morning talking about Tampa Bay Waterkeeper and the neighboring Suncoast Waterkeeper. And I'm playing daddy as well. I've got baby Miles in my arm, and hopefully he won't have too much to say until his mama gets home. But, I think maybe a few minutes of background about the Waterkeeper programs would be valuable. And it's a little bit of a story about how these organizations came about. They're part of the Waterkeeper Alliance, which now has over 350 member organizations around the world. And each of those organizations protects a local water body. Tampa Bay Waterkeeper protects Tampa Bay waterways. Suncoast Waterkeeper protects coastal waterways, basically around Sarasota, Manatee counties. So, you know, throughout where your listeners, a lot of your listeners are living. And the Waterkeeper started with the Hudson River Keeper up in New York, where I worked as an attorney 20-some years ago, and that was kind of the model of a kind of hard-hitting environmental organization that was very, very advocacy-oriented, used whatever tools were in the toolkit to protect waterways and the communities that rely on the health of those waterways from pollution. And that Hudson River Keeper really kind of grew through the environmental movement of where the Hudson River was just terribly toxic and polluted, and the fishermen and women that were trying to sustain their families, mainly the shad fishery on the Hudson. These guys were pulling up nets full of fish, and they could tell what color the pickup trucks were being painted at the Tarrytown General Motors plant from the color of the fish that they were pulling up, and they had basically had enough. And they were going to resort to blowing up the outfall pipe at the plant, and unfortunately, they took a turn, which I appreciate, to figure out other ways to try to address pollution, and they started using environmental laws that existed and were being developed at the time to stop polluters and to protect their waterways. And so that kind of grew into this now international movement, and Florida has now 15 waterkeeper organizations, and you know, we're scientists and lawyers and educators. We work together. The Suncoast and Tampa Bay Waterkeepers work together a lot to protect this area, which all of our waters, you know, are related. And whatever happens up in Tampa Bay may well impact Sarasota Bay, which is, I'm sure, one of the things we'll talk about today, which is, you know, Piney Point is a good example of that.
Do you guys do both freshwater and saltwater? Is it all waterways?
Yeah, it's all waterways. Our focus is on the estuaries, but you know, freshwaters will certainly flow into the estuary. So the estuary is the focus. And drinking water and aquifers and fresh waters as well are kind of within the purview. The organizations are small. You know, just a little bit more. Suncoast Waterkeeper is about 10 years old. I founded it. Tampa Bay Waterkeeper is about 4 years old. A really awesome guy named Andy Hayslip started the Tampa Bay Waterkeeper. And we're all all volunteers. We don't have any paid staff at this point. Really just hardworking board members and volunteers that have a big footprint and of course, rely on the support of volunteers and members and donors.
And you mentioned, this is Tanya, you mentioned that there's lawyers and scientists that volunteer with Tampa Bay Waterkeepers. Is it all made up of lawyers and scientists that volunteer and run this?
No, I mean, it's made up of mainly members, and those are people of all walks of life that support the work of the organization. And depending on what the issue is, we'll work with, try to fit the pieces of the puzzle together to deal with the problem. And I mean, we've been involved in water quality monitoring, recreational water quality monitoring, in that sense, people with an engineering or environmental or marine biology background have helped us to try to develop and maintain that program. And then we've been involved in some pretty intense litigation. And through the course of those cases, we've worked with and had to hire expert engineers to help us bring and ultimately prevail in those cases.
And you just brought up litigation. I'm assuming that you're talking about your new, I think you had a success recently, right, with Largo? Can you explain what happened with Largo and how Tampa Bay Waterkeepers made a difference?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're really happy. This settlement just came about a few weeks ago, and we announced it, I think, within the last 10 days, where we settled a case with City of Largo based on a violations of their permit and the Clean Water Act having to do with sewage. And let me just say that this kind of comes on the heels of several cases that the waterkeepers have brought in this area, starting with St. Pete, where I think it was 4 summers ago, their sewage spills were responsible for about half of the volume of sewage spills in the state of Florida. And that was our first Sewage Clean Water Act case that we successfully concluded with commitments to major upgrades to their sewage system. And then that went to Gulfport, where we had a similar success. And then Sarasota County, we brought an action that resulted in major upgrades, and then Largo followed that. So it's a similar pattern of municipalities that have aging sewage systems and have not been able to meet the requirements of their permit and the Clean Water Act to reduce and avoid contamination of local waterways.
So
and the problem with Largo...
No, please go ahead.
Question.
Sorry about that.
There are two problems, and I think it's the same with all municipalities. And wherever folks might be living, if you're on a municipal sewage system, you probably have these same issues of aging infrastructure. Aging, I call environmental infrastructure, where the collection system that goes from homes and offices and buildings that collect sewage and takes it to the treatment plant is made up of old pipes. And particularly in the rainy season, in this area with high water table, stormwater gets into those pipes. And when it rains a lot, it overwhelms the system. And the sewage has nowhere to go, so it finds manholes and outlets throughout neighborhoods and the community, and oftentimes those lead to local waterways. And those are collection system SSOs or overflows. And that's part one of the problem. Part two is once it goes to the treatment plant, in the case of Largo, they weren't adequately treating their sewage. And so they were discharging sewage that was partially treated into Old Tampa Bay. And for many, many years, they were violating their permit, and the state of Florida kept on giving them a pass and not ratcheting down to require that they make the fixes that they need to protect Old Tampa Bay.
We're talking with Justin Bloom from Tampa Bay Waterkeepers here on the Sustainable Living Show in WMNF Tampa. If you have any questions for our guest, give us a call at 813-239-9663 or email us at dj@wmnf.org and I will read your question. So when you're talking about Largo and their pollutants, how do you know that there's pollutants in the water, and how do you know any of these different companies or municipalities, how do you know they're the ones doing it?
Well, these are all permit holders. So Largo and other sewage system operators, they maintain their systems under a permit with the state of Florida. And it's under the Clean Water Act, which is a federal law, allows the states to regulate them. And part of their permit requires that they actually monitor the flows and the operation of their systems. And all this is publicly available. So, you know, the main body of evidence that we have was Largo's own records. If need be, we can do additional sampling, but in most of these cases, we don't have to. We just turn to the reported bills and monitoring reports of the entity, the violator.
So a lot of it is self-reporting and it's public record, and you just have to kind of put those pieces together?
Yeah, and and what we do is we're just not. There's a bit of a method to, who we target, and we look for. All sewage systems have violations. I mean, it's a difficult, incredibly complex, expensive system, no matter where it is. But some have just much higher incidence of violations, and they're much worse polluters than others. And in the case of Largo, they were actually flagged by the EPA as being a significant violator. And part of that was because just for so many years, they continued to exceed their permit levels. And I just also want to say, we're talking about Largo, that Largo didn't... They weren't hiding their head in the sand. They knew about this. They were working hard to and had allocated and were spending a lot of money to try to fix the problems. But our position was that it wasn't enough, and the state wasn't adequately pushing them to address these issues. So we felt that it was important because the state kept on giving them pass after pass after pass, year after year, and we didn't have confidence that the state was going to do their job to enforce the permit, and the Clean Water Act allows us to step into the shoes of an enforcer if they're not doing the job, and that's what we did.
So this might seem like a simple question, but I think a lot of people probably don't know. You talked a lot about how they have permits and there's violations of certain rules they're supposed to follow, but what are the rules they're supposed to follow? How are they supposed to dispose of all of these things, and why would they choose not to do it properly?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, nobody wants to. No city, wants to pollute local waterways, but they have to deal with the sewage one way or another, and it's expensive and it's a bit of a balance. I mean, so they need to try to manage with the budget that they have a complex and old system to try to treat their sewage as best they can. And the way that these permits work is usually they look to the receiving water body to adequately reduce the pollutants that are coming from the treated sewage so that they don't significantly worsen the water quality of the receiving water body. In this case, it was Old Tampa Bay. So they kind of make these targets with Tampa Bay in mind and with in mind how much Tampa Bay can accommodate. The main pollutants that we're talking about here are of concern to us were nitrogen. And Tampa Bay, for the last several years, has had these persistent algae blooms. Mm-hmm. These are bad algae blooms. And continuing losses of seagrasses. And there's a pretty good, solid scientific connection between too much nitrogen and the loss of seagrasses and algae blooms. So Largo was, for year after year after year, dramatically exceeding their allocation, let's say, of nitrogen, like the levels of nitrogen that were allowable to be polluted in Tampa Bay. And the levels that were set were considered to be protective levels. And so our main argument was like, hey, meet those levels that were in your permit, comply with the law. So the other thing that just, you know, it's a long answer to your question, but there are other requirements depending on where the city is. And the coastal cities that have direct discharges into waterways, like there aren't many left, but Largo has a permit to treat its sewage and then discharge it into Tampa Bay. The trend, and we'll see more of this for coastal cities, is that they are upgrading their treatment to the point where they've removed enough pollutants to be able to send it out into recycled water systems for irrigation or to discharge it into a aquifer recharge well to put it into the ground. So that's tertiary treatment. And so those are elevated protective levels for coastal cities and counties that have these permits that allow them to discharge into local waters.
You're listening to the Sustainable Living Show on WMNF 88.5. Today we're talking to Justin Bloom of the Tampa Bay Waterkeepers. If you have any questions for our guests, you can call us at 813-239-9663 or email us at dj@wmnf.org. So let's get into the nitty-gritty here. Do you think that you could explain a little bit about Piney Point and what happened and why it's such an issue?
Yeah, sure. I mean, before we get to that, I just want to say that the settlement, we're really happy because it's, you know, the city's committed, and now they, you know, through this lawsuit, they've basically increased in their efforts and their commitments to achieve compliance ultimately. And like I said, they were on the way, but they needed some extra help. And so the settlement reflects this increased commitment over the course of the next several years that we'll be able to continue to monitor. So we're really happy, and I think Largo should be happy as well. But
Piney
Point is
a great win.
Yeah, we're really, really pleased. And thank you for the support from our members that are listening and other people. But Piney Point's the big scary issue today. Could you reframe, or what was the question?
Just explain a little bit about Piney Point just as a whole. You know, what happened, why it happened, maybe why the results are dangerous.
Yeah. So, I mean, where we stand right now is Piney Point is a old legacy phosphogypsum stack that is located in Lower Tampa Bay, right next to the port of Manatee, Port Manatee, on the east side of the bay in northern Manatee County. And that site has been a nightmare from the beginning when it was an active fertilizer plant, a active site owned by the Mulberry Corporation, which owned another site on the forgive me if I'm mispronouncing it, the Alafia or Alafia. And both these plants were just notorious for polluting the bays. And Mulberry went out of business and went into bankruptcy. And then, you know, ever since then, it's been like just an ongoing nightmare. And I call it a ticking time bomb that ultimately the state of Florida owns. I mean, they took over operations for about 5 years. They owned and operated, not creating fertilizer at that point. It was closed down, and they were focused more on dealing with the closure of the site. And they had an opportunity back then to come and effectuate a closure plan. And why they need to close it is that these legacy sites, and you'll see them dotted throughout Florida, there are these mountains of byproduct, it's not a product, of waste, hazardous waste, that is a byproduct of the creation of fertilizer, that are these, you know, stacks, hundreds of feet tall in some cases, that dot the landscape. And on top of these stacks, they create ponds, retention ponds that are full of processed water, wastewater, stormwater. It's kind of a toxic stew. So in this case, at Piney Point, there was a breach. I think it was now 4 weeks ago. It's been a blur. And a discharge of 215 million gallons of this toxic stew, that the pollutant of greatest concern for Tampa Bay, like with Largo, is nitrogen. And that's the big, you know, how people have been trying to manage and improve the health of Tampa Bay over the last many years is focusing on nutrient pollution. And there are strict budgets and many, many millions of dollars spent to reduce the amount of nitrogen and to restore Tampa Bay. And this blew that all up with 215 million gallons of wastewater that had, you know, each gallon has 10 times the amount of nitrogen as raw sewage, and just a massive slug of pollution going into the bay. And it all should have been avoided. This was known for years and years, particularly, and I think most damningly, by the state of Florida, who's been pointing the finger to the owner of the facility that shares the blame. But I don't think they should be pointing the finger that way as much as more introspectively to look at the role and the failure of the state of Florida to adequately regulate this facility. And so it's turned into a nightmare that really threatens the health of not just Tampa Bay, but Northern Sarasota Bay and all the communities that rely on, you know, a healthy, beautiful waterway. That's why a lot of people live here.
And so what is it that is this causing the same sort of, would this cause the same sort of problems in the water, like just too much nitrogen and like die off of seagrasses and, you know, and on, of course, or is there more to it?
That's the main fear, and there may well be more to it. Once we try to really get our hands around the levels of pollutants, not just in the surface water discharge, the 215 million gallons, and that's been sampled pretty significantly, but what about the groundwater there? The state has yet to provide us with the requested reports of their groundwater monitoring, which also will impact Tampa Bay. And the groundwater is, you know, has a lot more of heavy metals and potentially radioactive components. But the surface water, yeah, the fear, kind of like you were suggesting, is algae blooms, harmful algae blooms. You know, the worst case scenario, I think, is that it fuels algae growth. We have algae, and we have algae blooms in our waterways, and it's a natural phenomenon. But what happens is with human sources of additional nitrogen from sewage spills, from septic tanks, from atmospheric deposition, runoff from the poop that you don't clean up after your dog, you know, all this stuff, forget about Piney Point. That alone is too much nitrogen. And it overwhelms our waterways, and it's like superfood for the algae. So they consume that, and they multiply and to the point where they basically take over, and they cloud the water column, and they will suck out all the oxygen from the water and starve the marine organisms like fish of air. They'll die. Then it'll be like a vicious cycle. They'll decay, create more fuel for these algae blooms, and And the seagrasses suffer because they rely on photosynthesis, and the water column becomes so cloudy that they can't, the rays of the sun can't reach the blades of the seagrass, and they die off. And seagrass is incredibly important to, it's incredibly important habitat for marine life and food for manatees and turtles.
That
really love.
That leads me to a million different questions.
Create like a super algae bloom.
Well, there's so many questions that I have for you after that, but first, I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to the Sustainable Living Show here on WMNF Tampa. If you have any questions, give us a call at 813-239-9663. Today, we are talking about the health of our waterways with our expert guest, Justin Bloom from Tampa Bay Waterkeepers. And we actually have a caller, Greg from Clearwater, is on hold. So, Greg, welcome to the Sustainable Living Show.
Hey, guys. Can you hear me?
Absolutely.
Yeah, thanks for talking about this today. I'm one of those people who was outraged by this whole thing because, as you have said, people have been pointing fingers for years. And what a lot of people aren't talking about is the whole reason that we have these stacks is because this phosphogypsum waste is radioactive. And there, I have been talking to the EPA. I've called the governor's office to find out why nobody is taking radiological information from this water. And the new plan is to dump these ponds, supposedly treat the water, which is not only high in nutrients, but it's very high in toxic chemicals, arsenic and nitric acid and really nasty stuff. And if they decide to treat this water somehow and pump it down below the aquifer into the earth to store it, that's maybe a solution, but now we're left with millions of tons of radioactive waste. And I have several times tried to call the EPA and literally been stonewalled. They will not give me any information. They will not give me any contact people who have any information. And they will not even explain why on their own website they're not tracking these more dangerous chemicals and the radiological information of this water. If this water is sitting on top of radioactive waste, there's absolutely no way that this water is not radioactive. And it concerns me greatly, especially because, as I said, I cannot get any answers. And I've even talked to several news organizations. And they tell me the same thing, that they're being stonewalled and they cannot get any information. How do we get the actual correct information? And I'll hang up and take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg from Clearwater, for calling in. Justin, how do we get information?
And Greg, that's a great question, and I share your frustration, and you're asking the right questions, and we don't have the answers, and I'm pissed, because we've been asking, too, made formal record requests, particularly to get the groundwater monitoring reports. I will say that the water, the 215 million gallons that spilled were pumped. I mean, it wasn't just spilled. There was a tear in the liner. There's a pond, basically, sits on top of these stacks that is tries to keep the water wastewater from interacting with the hazardous waste that sits below it. And there was a tear in the liner, and in order to protect the integrity of that stack, the mountain, from like complete collapse, they had to pump out 215 million gallons. Now, in that particular pond, that was not all processed water, which does have more of the heavy metals and other, really potentially dangerous toxins and potentially, high levels of radioactive material, and that all needs to be monitored. This one was fortunately not as bad because it had a lot of water in it and storm water and a lot less processed water. But there's a stack there remaining that has another couple hundred million gallons that is mainly processed water and has a lot worse stuff in it. But regardless, we don't have enough information about what remains and what was discharged and what's in the groundwater below, which, is flowing to the local creeks in Tampa Bay. And the state will not provide that information.
So when we talk about, again, Piney Point and all these toxins and radioactive material, How is that actually affecting us? How is it affecting our listeners, the people who live in the community?
Well, I think most of the community in that area is on municipal drinking water. I mean, I think that would be the first concern. Is are you, do you have a well? Are you drinking the groundwater that may be polluted from these stacks? And that,
would and people drinking from a well, could it be affecting their well water? Should people have their water tested?
Absolutely. If you live in the vicinity of Piney Point and you're drinking water from a well, you need to have that tested. I would not be drinking from that well right now. But the majority of the people that live in that area, if not all of them, I'm not entirely sure, are on municipal water from Manatee County. And that comes from wells that are far away, as well as surface water that would not be impacted by Piney Point. So I think that generally the drinking water supply is safe and would not be impacted from Piney Point. But
what about the boaters, the people who are swimming and fishing and eating the fish from this area? And who is it going to affect? I know that with the water current, it's affecting some areas more than others. Who is it affecting as far as the boaters, and is it a concern of the boaters and fishermen and swimmers?
It should be. And also, there are aquaculture facilities right near Piney Point for clams and oysters that are, you know, the bivalves that basically they will feed on this. So, yeah, they should be super concerned and be doing additional testing, which, you know, I think is coming up a bit short on the toxins in the test. So, and the extent of it is, it's been, there are really good modeling efforts from, I think it was USF, that shows the predictions of how this polluted wastewater is going to interact with the currents and tides and winds in Tampa Bay, which is super dynamic and difficult. But it shows it generally flowing from lower Tampa Bay towards the Gulf and potentially into the Manatee River and Anna Maria Sound, which is, by the way, experiencing a really nasty, harmful algae bloom right now.
So, and you talk about the oysters and the clams that are in that area. And clams and oysters can be used, right, to clean the waterways. So they are eating this material. Number one, should we be concerned eating clams and oysters in that area? And number two, because they are a filter, should we be putting more oysters and clams in the Tampa Bay in order to help filter out all these toxins?
I would say yes and yes. I mean, I think that there is incredible potential to restore populations of bivalves in Tampa Bay and Sarasota Bay and the river. They are natural filters, like you're saying, and also they provide really important structure. You know, as we are facing sea level rise and more dramatic storms, they hold it together. They are that part of that natural infrastructure, along with mangroves and the seagrasses, that prevent erosion and mitigate the impact of storms and sea level rise. So they're super important, and I think that is a great tool moving forward to try to foster the natural growth and enhance the put in oyster beds and clam beds. But as far as the guys that are producing there, you know, I'm worried about it. I don't think that there have they. One of the things the state did is they did, I think, offer or mandate additional testing. And my understanding is that, again, that the water that was discharged was the threat of that water was mainly the nitrogen. And I think that the heavy metals and other toxins in that giant pool of water were significantly less than what you would see in a typical chip stack. So from my understanding, it hasn't impacted the aquaculture facilities. And I would eat Lost Coast oysters and Two Docks clams tonight if I if I have a chance.
Okay. And so we have two emails that came in. The first one is from Sarah, and she said, what about the mosaic stacks? How secure do you feel about them, especially in a hurricane? From Sarah in Arcadia.
Yeah, I'm not comfortable at all with the mosaic stacks or any other stack. And I think that, you know, points to the failure again of the state to adequately protect us from these stacks, whether they're really old, abandoned stacks like Piney Point, or, you know, stacks that are being created now, that there is a failure of the state, and I would say the feds as well, because ultimately it's their, ultimately the responsibility goes up all the way up the chain to protect us from these. And I don't think that there's adequate safeguards in place. It is a very polluting industry, and, you know, there's nothing known that can be done with this waste once it's created. It's not a byproduct, because it's not a product. There's nothing safe you can do with the phosphor gypsum after they've created fertilizer. But yet, the federal government is still allowing, and we're challenging this, its use in road building to put in the roadbeds. Like it's, you know, it's like it's a beneficial product. It is hazardous and polluting from cradle to grave.
So, I mean, should we be writing our elected officials and let them ask them to what? Tighten the regulations? Stop allowing it to be produced?
Yeah, and actually, there, I'm glad you asked, if there's a really good petition that I encourage people to sign on to. It's called... I'll have to get to my laptop to make sure I'm right, but Phospho Gypsum Free America.
Well, send it to me, and I'll make sure to post it on the Sustainable Living Show on our Facebook page and get that out there.
I mean, that request is for the federal government to regulate it as a hazardous waste, which it doesn't, and it really should. And there's an exception now that I think was carved out by the powerful lobby of the phosphate gypsum fertilizer industry, to create a loophole to where this stuff is not considered a hazardous waste. And if the federal government steps up and does that, considers it and as a hazardous waste, then I think it's a lot easier to better regulate it, you know, the future production of fertilizer, and to better deal with the legacy, like Piney Point.
So we have another email from David. He says, could your guest address the problem with septic tanks in Florida? I was thinking that the septic problem is especially a problem in communities like Spring Hill and North Point, where the roads were platted and paved before the houses were built. But with no services provided, like wastewater, I worry about the poo-poo leaking out and getting into the aquifer. Stanky. From David.
Yeah, I worry about that too. I mean, that's a problem throughout the state. And it's like one of the things I mentioned earlier, there are a lot of sources of contamination, particularly the nitrogen, which is the main issue for phosphorus and nitrogen from septic tanks. And so, you know, when you, let's say if you're in a house with a septic tank, once it was initially put in, it probably operated just fine. But many of these septic tanks, if they're not properly maintained, they fail over years. And if you live close to a waterway, it's going to seep into local groundwater that's then going to flow to a waterway. And so I think these failing septic tanks throughout Florida and definitely in our region are problems, and they're definitely contributing to water pollution and poor water quality. And it's very expensive to remedy. I think homeowners need to step up to upgrade and maintain their septic systems, and municipalities need to step up and make the expensive but really good investment to try to tie in septic systems and homes and businesses that use them to centralized wastewater systems.
Well, you're listening to the Sustainable Living Show here on WMNF Tampa. We are talking today about the health of our waterways and a very pointed topic about Piney Point and how it is affecting our waterways and how septic tanks are polluting our waterways as well. We're talking with Justin Bloom from the Tampa Bay Waterkeepers. If you have any questions, give us a call at 813-239-9663 or email us at dj@wmnf.org.
So you touched on a little bit there about how homeowners can, you know, keep their septic tanks properly functioning and things like that. What are other things that regular citizens can do to help maintain the water quality in our community?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of, like, local things that people, everybody can do. And it's even, you know, things like planting a Florida-friendly lawn that doesn't require fertilizer or doesn't have as much runoff. These are all things that contribute to the big problem that we have of reducing nitrogen. This doesn't deal with the toxics as much, but reducing nitrogen in our bays, because, I mean, it's bad. Like, we just got reports from the Southwest Florida Water Management District that does aerial surveys showing, like, some pretty significant reductions in seagrass populations. And that's from where we've been recovering for decades, and now we're slipping. So those little things all contribute. Like I mentioned earlier, you know, clean up after your pets. Don't change your oil on the driveway and spill oil. The things that you guys, I think, talk about. I listen to the show every once in a while about sustainable living. They all add. And, you know, you can do things like go to Tampa Bay Waterkeeper and Suncoast Waterkeeper and sign on to that petition. Join your local organizations that amplify your voice. If you feel that the work that we're doing is impactful and meaningful to you, you know, be part of it and join us and help support it, support our work. And then reach out to your local elected officials and your HOAs and your community groups and raise the volume on this. I mean, demand that our decision makers really take this stuff and focus on it and make it a priority. Because it's not. I mean, it's in this state in particular, the environment has fallen to the wayside, secondary to business interests and polluters' interests. And we need to change that, change the scales. And so people need to really be loud about what's important to you, and then to support efforts that are consistent with environmental protection.
So, you know, the more informed people are, the better, and I think the more passionate they can be about something. You guys have some tools that are available for the community so that they can see, you know, the kind of what's happening in their water. So could you talk about your swim guide and your water quality program so that people know where they can go to figure out what issues are affecting the water that they're actually using?
Sure. I mean, I encourage people to check out your local waterkeeper, get on the website, look at the Facebook page, the TampaBayWaterkeeper.org, SuncoastWaterkeeper.org. We do recreational water quality monitoring, which is, it's pretty basic. It's just, it's looking at bacteria levels in sites around Tampa Bay, Sarasota Bay, the same type of monitoring that the counties do at the public beaches. That are, you know, really popular, especially with tourists. But we know that, you know, folks that live here like to go fart around in our bays and fish and wade and paddle and in the bays, and they don't do that type of sampling in the bays. So we do, and we find some really, and in the rivers, we're doing Hillsborough River as well, some concerning levels of bacteria, which suggests sewage contamination. But, you know, we don't have the capacity to really drill down and find out what the cause is and the source. So we try to work collaboratively with the communities where we're getting these high levels and high readings to get them to try to investigate the sources. You know, other tools, you can go to our websites, but there are other really good organizations in the community as well that, that we like to work with collaboratively, and might, you know, the Tampa Bay S-Way program is a great source, and they actually have a lot of tools on their website. Tampa Bay Watch, Surf Rider, your Sierra groups, you know, we're all working towards the same thing, and you know, we don't really haven't been doing cleanups, but Tampa Bay Watch does a lot of cleanups where people can really get hands on, and you know, we celebrate the work that all of our environmental partners do. But you know, we play, I think, a different role where we are more a bit more hard hitting and use that litigation tool and that kind of maybe outspoken advocacy. We're pretty responsive and don't have a lot of bureaucracy like some national organizations. So, yeah.
And actually, we have a hold on 1 second. We do have a caller listening. But actually, before that, I want to talk about a little bit about stormwater. So stormwater is obviously a big problem with the Bay. Is living shorelines a possible solution to help filter the stormwater before it makes it to the Bay?
Yeah, they're expensive, though. I mean, all these things are great. They're great. Those projects excite me so much. And living shorelines, even, you know, we're talking about increasing the bivalve populations. They can be incorporated in these living shorelines along with mangroves and seagrasses. It's really to create that structure where habitat can thrive. And that structure also, which would protect from sea level rise and storms, and that habitat also will filter pollution. But they're really expensive, and I think, you know, fundamentally, I think we need to focus more at reducing pollution at its source, which is so much cheaper than trying to fix it, you know, once it's in our complex ecosystem.
It seems like there's just a reasonable solution. Like, instead of an expensive seawall, getting a grant or putting in a living seawall that will make the situation better versus worse is important and needs to be part of the discussion. But we have two callers, so let's move to Jim, who is driving. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Good morning, guys. Hey, Justin, you know, you say put a petition, you know, sign a petition and all that stuff. Every couple of years or so, whatever, the Florida legislature changes the leadership. And they look 10 to 12 years down the road because they know no matter how many times that they kick your dog or steal your money, you're going to vote for the same people. So you got the same party in there. All they care about is business. They don't care about anything else. Piney Point has been a thorn in the side for, what, 20 years? Years ago, they put $100 million into taking care of that, and then they leased it to a company so they could make a couple million dollars. Now we're going to put $200 million into it, and that's taxpayer money. It's all for business, and it's almost like you raise your hands up in the air until people start voting in other parties and other people that care and are responsible to the public. They don't care.
Great point. What's your answer? Thanks, Jim. That's a great point. Justin, yeah. Do you feel like electing different local officials, more environmentalists, will have a change in our local policies and will affect the environment?
I think it's super important. Gosh, I hope so. It is a very very business-friendly legislature at the state level and in many of our communities. You know, the local governments are responsive more to businesses and big donors than they are general population. And so, absolutely. I mean, we're not a political organization. We're made up of Democrats and Republicans, and we don't have a political agenda except an agenda of clean water. And so we absolutely encourage people to take a look at how you're legislators, how your lawmakers are governing, and take a look at their environmental records and judge for yourself, and then look at people that are running. And so I do think that we need a lot of change. And I think one of the other things, I hear the frustration in the caller's voice, like, you know, we've had a lot of success. I mean, I think one of the tools that we use is litigation, and it can be very powerful and impactful and create a lot of change And we're going to continue doing that. And I hope that, I think that in cases to come, some of those changes are going to be really kind of statewide and fundamental, that will try to balance out those special interests and to try to force the state to better regulate and better constrain polluters.
And then let's move to Clay from Land O'Lakes. Clay, welcome to the Sustainable Living Show.
Thanks for taking my call. So I want to go back a bit to talk about deep well injection. One of the first ones they were using for what's supposed to be treated wastewater was in St. Petersburg. I went to a meeting in downtown Tampa with the EPA, held by the EPA and FDEP, regarding whether or not they would renew the permit. And the science was showing that there was upward movement, which there wasn't supposed to be at the well. They went ahead and approved it anyway, and now they've approved many more. So I have two questions. Do you know who monitors the quality of the water before they put them into these deep wells, first? And second, you need to talk about the fact that the systems themselves are not capable of handling Florida's weather. Whenever we have a large rain event, all these systems are overwhelmed because stormwater mingles with the sewage water, gets in there, and they end up having these discharges of untreated waste because they have no storage capacity. If you could speak to those issues, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Clay, sure, for the great question. Justin?
Yeah, and we don't have a lot of time left, but absolutely. I mean, the regulated, anybody that has a deep injection well or aquifer recharge well, they are required, and they have permits that require them to monitor the fluids that are going in those wells, and that's all publicly available. And hopefully those wells operate, right, and keep
the Fox is watching Chicken House?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But then there's a role, if you know, if they're adequately reporting and if they're a municipality, they typically do, then we can look and make sure that they're meeting their required levels. But, you know, deep well injection it's scary. I mean, there's no good options for dealing with pollution, you know. And, you know, there have been some failures historically. Pinellas County and Miami-Dade, decades ago, had some really bad failures with deep injection. And I think the technology has improved, but certainly not, you know, doesn't give me the greatest confidence in that, dealing with wastewater, and particularly not with dealing with the wastewater on top of these gyp stacks, which is what Manatee County wants to do with the remaining wastewater.
Well, it seems like the potential for disaster is just so much greater when you talk about that. Well, thank you for the great question, Clay. We are running out of time. I have one last email. This is from Bubba. I visited Eckerd Menard Park in Dover area yesterday, and it's a former phosphate mine. The water in the lake there is very green. Why is that?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, probably green water is probably a lot of chlorophyll and algae bloom, and there's probably a lot of nitrogen in that. Doesn't mean that it necessarily mean it's toxic, but yeah, the broader point is like Mosaic is really good at touting themselves as being environmental stewards, and they do a lot of reclamation, but it doesn't really work out too well in the end.
Yeah, if they're the cause of the majority of the issues that they're trying to resolve. Well, Justin, you have been an absolutely amazing guest. Thank you so much. If anybody wants to contact you, how is the best way?
Go to our website, or just email me at jbloom, J-B-L-O-O-M, at suncoastwaterkeeper.org or tampabaywaterkeeper.org.
Awesome. Well, that was Justin Bloom from Tampa Bay Waterkeepers. And let me see, they wanted me to let everybody know that Richard Wolf Economic Update will be weekly Tuesdays at 10 a.m. now. And Grace, do you want to tell our listeners about the next show?
Yeah, let's do it. Join us 2 weeks from now on the Sustainable Living Show Tampa. We're going to talk to Travis Malloy of Meacham Urban Farm about all things local food and farming.
Awesome. Well, thank you to everybody. We'll see you in 2 weeks. And thank you to Frank Knox for helping us with the boards.
And you are so welcome.
Keep grazing in the grass. Like the show.
Grazing in the Grass, UMass Aquila. This is WMNF Tampa. Stay tuned for NPR News.